From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, The Occult. And happy birthday to David Webb of Timmins, Ontario. Hope you enjoy it, David. By the way, Thursday, tomorrow's program will be our Art Bell tribute show. As many of you know now that Art passed away last Friday at the age of 72, we will have special guests on the program, your phone calls, memorable moments, and some highlighted clips from some of Art's programs. That's tomorrow night. Here's what's happening. Federal air safety officials investigating why the engine of a Southwest Airlines jet blew apart, killing a passenger after shattering a plane window, said that the incident began when a fan blade, already suffering metal fatigue, snapped off in mid-flight. Scary situation. The National Transportation Safety Board chairman, Robert Sumwalt, told a news conference that he could not say yet if the incident, the first deadly airline accident in the United States since 2009, pointed to a fleet-wide issue in the Boeing 737-700 series planes. In Atlanta, a Delta jet departing from the world's busiest airport there made an emergency landing after smoke was seen pouring from one of the plane's engines. No injuries. A former 911 operator who hung up the phone thousands of times on people attempting to call in emergencies in Harris County, Texas, has now been sentenced to jail time. The 44-year-old woman was found guilty of interference with emergency telephone calls after systematically hanging up the phone on residents of Harris County. She was sentenced to 10 days in jail, 18 months probation. Can you believe that? People calling for an emergencies and the 911 operator just hangs up. Forget the Golden State. California should now be called the Smoggy State. 8 of the USA's 10 most polluted cities in terms of ozone pollution are in California, according to the American Lung Association. The Los Angeles-Long Beach area took the dubious distinction of being the nation's most ozone-polluted city, as it has for the entire 19-year history of the report. Bakersfield, California was second. Other California cities on the list include Fresno, Sacramento, San Diego. The only non-California metro areas in the top 10 list were Phoenix and New York City. Officials are warning that hackers from the Russian government are targeting an electronic item found in millions of homes and businesses across the United States. Russian spies are reportedly trying to hack into routers. Why? Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the Internet. Why are they doing this, Lauren?
They're doing it because if you own the router, you own the data. I mean, it doesn't matter if we're talking about the big, massive routers that handle the Internet's backbone traffic, whether we're talking about enterprise-size routers that the big businesses use for their traffic, the SoHo routers, small businesses, even the little routers and switches you have in your home. If those are compromised, there's practically no limit of what can be done with them.
How do you hack into a router?
The main reason this is happening is because there's so much poorly designed equipment. There's a lot of legacy equipment out there that's never been changed. And we've talked about how you go out, you buy a router for your home, and it's important to change the passwords, right? There's businesses who buy these things on an enormous scale, and they don't even bother changing the passwords.
Interesting.
Or they choose bad passwords. Or one way or another, they're left open. And when they're left open that way, it's not just a matter of an adversary being able to route the data somewhere else and cause you, you know, a lot of hassle that way. There are often ways to spy on the traffic. They let the traffic go to where it's supposed to go, but they also have a copy feeding back to Moscow or wherever. And this is on an endemic level. I mean, it's just going on all the time. And what's happening now and what these new government warnings are about is that it's been very clearly determined now that there are organized efforts by Russian state-sponsored hackers to do this on an enormous scale. And if you work on it on a large enough scale, you get enough jackpots. Sometimes important defense industries, who knows what,
Jeez.
They can do an enormous amount of damage.
Why are the Russians doing all this now?
they want information any way they can get it. They want control any way they want it, any way they can get it. There's another story going on right now too. The Russians over the last few days blocked about 20 million internet IP addresses, mostly of Google and Amazon cloud services, because they were trying to block Telegram, which is an encrypted messaging app. And they did it in such a ham-fisted, inept way that they started blocking services of everyone else, and more. And Telegram managed to more or less continue running just fine for a while. Now there's talk that Iran is going to probably do the same thing. So it's just one thing after another now.
Crazy times. Okay, thanks a lot, Lauren. Appreciate everything you do for us. President Trump has told reporters he would not hesitate to walk out of a planned summit meeting with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un if I think it's a meeting that is not going to be fruitful. Interesting there. Making a meal out of a dog or cat may soon land you in jail. Well, that's good. An amendment being considered by the House Agriculture Committee would change the Animal Welfare Act to bar people from knowingly slaughtering a dog or cat for human consumption, as well as transporting or participating in other commercial activity related to eating pet meat. The alleged thief behind Iceland's big Bitcoin heist has escaped from prison, and he's now in Sweden. He's accused of stealing 600 cryptocurrency mining computers, netting about $2 million worth of mining hardware. Oil prices rising to their highest level since the late 2014 time, after government data showed that U.S. crude stockpiles fell last week as the market continued to worry about supply disruptions in key fuel-producing nations. Catherine Austin Fitz, our registered investment advisor, with us. What do you think about the economy over the next several months, Catherine?
Well, the economy is, thanks to the tax cuts in the U.S., is going to be relatively strong this year. But I think the long-term, George, has some real problems on the horizon. So after the election, we could be in for some rough sledding. Now, a lot of money is being repatriated in a lot of operations. So in some sense, that'll help the corporate economy, but you've got trade wars on the horizons, you've got cyber insecurity everywhere, and basically a world at war. So we can't trade. You know, Jack Ma once said, he said, when trade stops, war starts. And there's too many drumbeats of wars everywhere.
Yeah, there sure is. And Catherine, as we look ahead toward, 2020, some people are starting to throw their hats in the ring for the presidential election. Still way, way too early to predict anything. But what's your gut telling you?
My gut is telling me that, the U.S. population is going to be so frustrated by the time we get there.
They are now.
In for some unexpected scenarios.
You got that right. Catherine, thank you so much. Up next, we're going to be talking about our Germans. Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Fascinating. Next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you. Brian Krim, our special guest for the next couple hours. He is the John Mills Turner Distinguished Chair in the Humanities at the Lynchburg College in Virginia. Received his doctorate in modern European history from Reuters University. His teaching and research interests include the Holocaust, military history, Modern Europe and Intelligence and National Security Studies. Dr. Krim was an intelligence analyst for the Departments of Defense and Homeland Security between 2001 and 2005. His work, Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Brian, welcome to the program, and this is a fascinating subject for me.
Thank you so much, George. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and I've been studying it off and on for about 20 years now. So, yeah, it is truly fascinating and touches on so many different levels of scholarship as well.
A lot of our listeners know what Project Paperclip is, but there are many that come on that don't. Could you explain that for us?
Sure. So Paperclip is essentially a plan conceived in the final months of World War II, but put into action in that summer of 1945 to envision a long-term exploitation of Germany's scientific and technical infrastructure for the benefit of primarily defense, but later even commercial interest. So it's a two-year program from 1945 to 1947, but it'll survive under different names all the way up until the 1970s, honestly.
Now, the Soviets had a similar type program at the same time, did they not?
They did. Each ally planned to exploit, as they put it in the technical their technical reports, exploit German technology. But the Soviets were, you know, had a different take on it. They were kind of trying to catch up and would go for quantity over quality, which I think was more just the fact that they weren't able to attract the best minds the way that the Western allies were.
I was going to say, how did we get Wernher von Braun and the Soviets did not?
Well, it's interesting because Peenemünde, which was the complex that built the V-2 initially and was on the Baltic coast and firmly in Soviet territory, but the SS, which was in control of the program in the final year of the war, really after the assassination plot against Hitler, the SS really took control of everything, they feared that this would be that they would be under the control of the Soviets, and moved the German scientists into the interior of the country. And somewhere along the line in April, May of 1945, as everything is disintegrating, Wernher von Braun took his brother, Magnus, and about a dozen other of his trusted leading team leaders into the interior of the country toward Bavaria, where they knew that they would come into contact with American troops. So they deliberately moved toward the advancing American army, knowing that that would be their best shot to be able to continue their work with all the resources they could ever imagine.
The Germans, under the guidance of von Braun and others, were launching V-2 rockets into London and Britain. How far ahead, Brian, were the Germans with missile technology compared to the United States, for example?
Well, it's a good question, and I think most historians of science and technology would say that they were about 5 years ahead when
wow.
it came to rocketry.
That's amazing. I mean, even though we had the atomic bomb and they were really close to getting it, in terms of missile technology, they were 5 years ahead of us?
Yeah, and as you noted, with the unknown factor of how close were the Germans to the atomic bomb, the real fear that Eisenhower had and his technical advisors was what if they could marry an atomic device to what they already knew were successful guided missiles. And so that was what part of the urgency of getting the team, the rocket team, under Allied control was that if this, not only would this prevent some miracle weapon that the Germans could launch at the last minute, but also they're thinking ahead to the Soviets. What if they also were able to marry a atomic device mm-hmm. to a captured missile? So on two levels, there was this great fear, and it was more the unknown. It wasn't so much that we knew they had these capabilities. It was we don't know, and certainly we know that they have a guided missile, but that unknown is what really drove what was first called Operation Overcast, and then later Paperclip.
Brian, speculate just for a moment for me. What would have happened had Germany and Hitler obtained atomic weapons with their missile technology? How far would they have gone with using it?
Well, yes, it's a haunting question, and it's one that I think
they would have annihilated everything.
There was no doubt, especially in that desperate moment. Now, the question is, would they have used it on the Eastern Front or the Western Front? Clearly, most of the war for Germany lied in the Eastern Front. Really, even during D-Day, 80% of their army was still engaged in the East as opposed to the West.
Mm-hmm.
So it's likely that the Soviets would have been the primary target. But the idea of holding a city like London and even Washington, they had plans for something called the A-10, which is a V-3, you might call it, was a plan to actually have a rocket that could be transatlantic. To hold a city hostage like that would have been crucial in whatever peace negotiations would have occurred. But I think, honestly, the Eastern Front would have been an actual target. And that's
had Hitler,
the whole nature of the war.
If he had hit simultaneously Moscow, Paris, London with atomic weapons, he would have won the war.
Absolutely. And it would have been certainly Nazi propaganda was promoting this idea that there were these wonder weapons, not only for their own population, but for the Allied audiences, that you know this, that there was perhaps a danger in pressing the war to the point of completely annihilating Germany.
I'd be speaking this show in German with you.
Yes, and
my God,
that would have been good for German departments around the country, but that's about it.
So the Operation Paperclip occurs. We get the cream of the crop. They come to the United States. Von Braun, of course, as I remember during my youth, was very instrumental in developing the rockets, the Saturn V, everything it took to get us to the moon.
Yes, I think that's yes and no. I mean, he's an excellent team leader. And one of the things that I found this great quote from a Caltech physicist named Fritz Zwicky, who was one of the first to really analyze all the technical achievements of the V2 team, and had this very honest assessment. He called the V2 and you know the German rocket team generally, quote, a technical achievement of high order due less to the activity of any individual genius than to the determined and enthusiastic cooperation of a large number of only moderately technical individuals. And what I think he means by that, and what was von Braun's true talent, is that he could take something that was on a blueprint and turn it into an actual working device and mass produce it. And that is something the United States lacked when it came to rocketry at the end of the war, and something that NASA wanted when it was decided should it be an Army agency or be civilian. Von Braun had already proven himself as someone who could take, who was an organizational genius more so than his own scientific prowess as a physicist. He was a custom made for, I think, the American military industrial complex. Take the blueprint and turn it into a working device. That's not a small accomplishment, but it's also not something that you could also argue that a number of American scientists could have done the same thing. He just was given more authority and power than he even could have imagined during the Third Reich.
Our special guest for the first half, Brian Krim, his book is called Our Germans, Project Paperclip at the National Security State. If you are of German heritage, this is not intended to be an indictment of your heritage by any means. We're talking about how we exploited Nazi technology after World War II. Brian, why didn't we take advantage of Japanese scientists after we won that war?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's a complex one. The first thing is we certainly were concerned about their progression with an atomic weapon, as we were with the Germans. Again, it was an unknown factor, so we immediately sent similar types of teams, technical teams, T forces they were called in Europe, but the similar idea to evaluate Japanese scientists, and they made major advances in aeronautics, long range bombers, but for one, we didn't need to extradite them from Japan to the United States because we weren't dealing with three other allied powers, including the Soviet Union. We could use, if there was anything to exploit, we could exploit them in country. But there's also, it has to be said, and certainly the scholarship will prove this, that we had a very racial attitude that considered the Japanese inferior. On the same level, we assumed that the Germans were superior.
Mm-hmm.
Both of those were inaccurate. But there is a lot of discussion about should we bring Japanese scientists to the United States, and we did bring about 30 for something called Project 77 to deal with some boutique technology they created. But the FBI and some other agencies said do not bring them to the United States. It'll inflame racial passions. It'll be hard to cover. A German can blend into America pretty well, but a Japanese scientist cannot. So the combination of both having complete control of the Japanese islands and not having to worry about the Soviets stealing them from us, but also racial animus, that maybe they're not just as good as the Germans. And so there was this debate that went on until 1948 about whether we should have a similar program. But given the problems Paperclip provided a lot of bureaucrats, it was a hassle. It was also publicly, and once it was made public, unpopular, they decided why make that mistake twice with science, with a race of people, as they called it, who are more hated than the Germans were.
We're going to come back in a moment with Brian Krim and talk more about his work, our Germans, Project Paperclip, and the national security state. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls. I love some of these historical interviews with people who know what they're talking about. It's really something. His website, it's so long, I'll just tell you it's linked up to coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back. You are by far the greatest radio audience in the history of radio, and we are so proud to have you part of this program. Thank you, all of you, for the years that you've been participating with this program, going way, way back. Lots of live stage shows coming up. The first next one, Saturday. This coming Saturday in Scottsdale, Arizona. I can't believe how quickly this one has popped up. It's at the special Virginia G. Piper Theater. And tickets are selling like hotcakes, but you still can get some good seats. You're not left out. How do you get these good seats? Well, you go to our website, coasttocoastam.com, click the events at the top of the homepage, and look for the Scottsdale event, and go right into there. But remember the date, April 21st, when you get in there. Or you can look at our carousel reel. That's the revolving series of pictures that Lex has posted on our website. And you'll see that, and that will come up. That's April 21st, Scottsdale, Arizona. Come on by, meet and greet after the program. It's going to be a great time. I'm looking forward to it. Then Las Vegas, Nevada, June 9th. We're going to the Silverton Casino, and we're going to have a live stage show there. We're doing this with our affiliate KXNT. Really looking forward to this event as well. Full information, go to coasttocoastam.com. Click the events again, and you'll get there. And then, as we just announced yesterday, Saturday, August 25th, we are coming back to Asheville, North Carolina.
We are going to invade them again. This is just going to be another great show. This is going to be a lot of fun.
That's the voice of Tom Danheiser, our producer.
Yeah, I think they know that's not you. But so we're going to hit the Diana Wortham Theater on Saturday, August 25th. Our guests are going to be the Rocket Man, David Adair. We're going to have a lot of fun. He's going to team up with Micah Hanks, and they're going to talk about Area 51 and ufology. William Forstchen will talk about our planet and the grid and so forth. And then, of course, the wacky world of Joshua P. Warren. Never can forget Joshua. Everybody seems to love Josh and all the guests, really. And then we're going to have Vincent Jenna. Vincent is a spiritual teacher and a psychic medium. He's one heck of a guy, folks. You really got to hear this guy. He's really a good guy. It's a lot of great information, a live band, audience participation, and meet and greet to follow. This event is going to be at the Diana Wortham Theater. You can call 828-257-4530. Or go to dwtheater.com. And theater is spelled T-H-E-A-T-R-E.
And you just put all those letters together.
Mm-hmm. And
no separation.
That's correct. And you can also go to the Coast to Coast AM website.
And I went on the line this morning after one day of announcing this, and there's a whole block of tickets that are already sold right in the middle.
Those were all berries.
Well, I was going to say, you can also come to Asheville not only to see our live program, but to see Barry, as he's going to be out there.
Maybe we'll make him dance.
No, let's not do that. All right, thanks, Tom. And we're going to come back in a moment as we continue with Brian Grimm as we talk about our Germans, Project Paperclip, and the national security state. And welcome back to Coast, Brian Grimm with us, his book, Our Germans. Brian, did the Brits or the French get any German technology or German scientists after the war?
Yes, they did. In fact, with so many things related to World War II, it was a lot. Anglo-American cooperation was the name of the game. Remember, our intelligence community was essentially modeled after the British. They had to teach us everything until we, you know, outgrew our britches and kind of took over that world for ourselves. So initially, there was a plan with the British to share the rocket team, and they first went to Britain for a few weeks before they ever made it to Texas and New Mexico, launching already built V2s into the North Sea. But eventually, the British, with their financial problems, didn't have much to offer scientists as far as a long-term contract went. So over time, we stopped looking at the scientists as POWs almost immediately. We stopped thinking of it that way, and more as valued contractual employees. So we have more to offer them than the British did. And so while we still shared everything we had with the British, they were essentially working for either the U.S. Army or General Electric or whomever. The French are a different story because they were, honestly, when it came to all things relating to the occupation of Germany, far more problematic in these early years than the Soviet Union was. They treated their zone of occupation like it was to be, you know, just plundered it at will. They would actually steal scientists from the U.S. and British zones, push scientists into moving cars to get them into the French zone. They would lure German scientists into hotel rooms with attractive women, and there would be a French agent there waiting for them, and put them into a car into their zone. And so they had the benefit of being close to Germany, so they could swish someone across the border. But they did not get the best scientists, and they did not have the infrastructure to exploit them properly or with the same benefit as the United States did. But yeah, every ally Saul initially said it's every man for himself, and luckily the United States had the bigger paychecks to offer, but that was really what the only thing we could have done to outdo our sometimes friends and other rivals.
Brian, not everybody was jumping for joy with Project Paperclip. How come?
Well, you had there's a very interesting Gallup poll that was done once the Army had to announce Paperclip because it was too large and expansive. Too many cities were having German communities pop up, and it was overwhelmingly negative and against the idea of paperclip. If you ask a U.S. citizen a few months after the war, how do you feel about bringing 1,000 Nazi scientists?
Well, it would have been totally opposed.
Exactly. So, then you also have to ask how adamant are they? How adamant do they feel about that in the long run? So it was the Army bet on the idea that this hostility would end with time, and they were correct. But then you have people like Albert Einstein, who once he finds out about it, is writing an editorial in the New York Times calling the Nazi scientists or German scientists but the bacillus carriers of Nazism. And he was horrified, as were so many other prominent German Jewish scientists. You had Rabbi Stephen Wise opposed. You had the NAACP. You had the Federation of American Scientists, which was comprised primarily of Manhattan Project scientists, totally opposed to it. And then you have a large number of bureaucrats in mostly civilian agencies who are not opposed to exploiting German scientists, but adamantly opposed about the idea of giving them citizenship. Now, that was the real issue. Not, of course, you exploit them. They're part of the plunder of war. But giving them citizenship was appalling to a huge chunk of the bureaucracy.
Just amazing that all this seemed to fall into place. Now, there was a submarine, a German submarine headed for Japan called U-234, which had some uranium in it. What the heck was that all about?
Yeah, it was a shocking find. U-234 was Hitler's last gift to Japan. You might call it one of the few gifts to Japan. In the final year of the war, Hitler kept fielding numerous requests from the Japanese to share in some of these advanced aeronautics, especially anti-aircraft missiles, which you can imagine Japan would have needed greatly, as well as radar and all these other advances. After all, they were allies. But Hitler resisted. But once he knew, starting in January of 1945, that things were going to end, even he had to recognize that, he did allow the shipment of both scientists, uranium oxide, a fully deconstructed Messerschmitt 262, the jet aircraft, and some other technology, but mostly radar, to make this perilous journey across the world to Japan. But so when Admiral Karl Dönitz, who was the head of the U-boat fleet, but also the last Führer of the Third Reich, he's the one that actually signed the surrender papers in 1945, he ordered all the U-boats to surface where they were and surrender. So off the coast of Nova Scotia, on May 14th, 1945, U-234 is captured. They know that they're going to Japan. And the uranium oxide was one of the reasons why there was this great fear that maybe Japan had progressed with a nuclear program. In actuality, that uranium oxide was meant to be aviation fuel. But one of the crew, or one of the passengers of U-234 was a man named Heinz Schlicke, who wound up being a prominent paperclip scientist who worked for decades, both with the Army and in private industry. And this U-234 incident was proof that there was possible collusion between Japan and Germany, and the unknown factor, again, is what prompted Paperclip to accelerate. Is what else are they? What else do they have? What are they? What have they shared with Japan? We're still at war with Japan. We're months away from the July test of the atomic bomb and the end of the war. So this was a real reminder to the intelligence infrastructure that the war is still going on and we still don't know quite what has been shared.
People like Wernher von Braun came here and no doubt helped our rocket program, and the Soviets had Germans that helped their rocket program as well. But they were still people in the war, and they were building missiles that killed people. Did anybody just not forgive them for that?
Well, honestly, when it came to Wernher von Braun in the American side, because we were not the victims of the V2, there wasn't much controversy, and it's kind of alarming how, in one perspective, that they were so easily accepted. The reason I call the book Our German, that's from a Bob Hope joke, that right after Sputnik, October 1957, that was like Pearl Harbor. It was that's exactly how Lyndon Johnson described it, and Bob Hope kind of wanted to relax America's tensions. He was as a great comedian, and he said, well, he was joking. He said, well, all this proves is that their Germans are better than our Germans. And of course, that was as a way to kind of alleviate this situation, but it proved that we have started to think of them as our Germans. They had settled in Huntsville, Alabama, and had their own community. They had their own opera night. They had.
Was it well known in this country at the time that we had them here? Or was it kind of quiet?
Yeah. It was quiet for only maybe the first 6 months.
By
1946, they're Wright Field, Ohio, and places in New Mexico, they all had these, invited the press in to get a sense of who they were. And you will always find, and I have a lot of FBI files where you have veterans who will threaten the scientist on the street, or certainly Jewish veterans group were greatly opposed to them. But it was... not an issue here, but the British, though, wanted to arrest Walter Dornberger, who was the Wehrmacht general, really in charge of the V2. He was Wernher von Braun's boss. And it was only because we whisked him away at the last minute to America that he escaped imprisonment in Britain for the crime of building the V2 and killing about 5,000 British civilians. Walter Dornberger wound up being the vice president of Bell Labs and a multimillionaire well into the 1970s. So we were gracious. The British were a little more intense about their feelings toward the German scientists, and the Russians, well, they didn't care what they did in the war as long as they could help.
Well, let me ask you this about Sputnik. I was 7 years old when this happened, but I remember it, and I remember my parents kind of concerned because the Russians had beaten us. But how did they get there quicker than we do when we apparently had the cream of the crop of the German intelligence?
Yes, and that's something that enraged Wernher von Braun, because he was arguing that we could have done this all along much sooner, and it was part of his frustration with how the army bureaucracy worked. But the truth is, there were German scientists that helped the Soviets, but they were far more careful and wary of German scientists than we were. We entrusted them almost immediately with everything, where the Soviets, by their nature and Stalin's nature, and certainly after his death, it didn't change. That allowing foreigners and enemy aliens at that to have all of our all of the country's secrets was not a good idea. So they kind of took what they could from the Germans, which is to how do we catch up to a V2 level technology. But we forget that the Soviets had brilliant scientists, brilliant physicists, mostly theoretical. Now, what the Germans gave them, similar to what they gave us, was that idea, once again, of taking the blueprint and turning it into an actual product. But most of the work, has to be said, for Sputnik was actually done by Soviet scientists. They had Helmut Grotrup, who was the sort of number four, I would say, at Peenemünde, Wernher von Braun's associate, who managed the team of Germans. But they, you know, big science is the word for it, worked a lot better under a command economy than it did in the United States. And it was really within a few months anyway that we had the equivalent of a Sputnik rocket up. But that's it. So we're essentially, it was a shock to the world, but it was a parallel progress, you have to say, in both nations.
It's an incredible story. Are there any scientists alive today from Project Paperclip, or are they all dead now?
You know, there was, I saw a obituary early, maybe in the fall, for a paperclip scientist who is maybe 100 years old. But there has to be, because honestly, the average age of the paperclip scientist was under 40 when they came to the United States.
So there might be a few. There might be a few.
Yeah, there were. And in fact, there's a lot of, since I wrote the book, I've been contacted by a number of children of the paperclip scientists who, you know, are in their 60s. And so why a lot of these paperclip scientists had a second family when they came to the United States. They were allowed to bring their families with them. But Wernher von Braun, for example, has a son who's is only 50 years old right now. He had him very late in life.
Gosh. Nikita Khrushchev has a son who's living in the United States now. So if we did not have the German know-it-all, if we didn't get those scientists, where do you think our programs would be today? Our space program, would we have gotten to the moon? Would we have, you know, just gotten to the moon? Where do you think we'd be?
Well, you know, one of the things I kept encountering in my research is a lot of resentment and anger from American scientists who were upset about how the military conceived of German scientists as being better than American scientists. And it's true. They called it, even in the documents, the myth of the great German inventive mind. And it angered people like Theodor von Karman, who's a great jet engineer.
Sure. I bet Oppenheimer was upset.
Of course. And all everyone who, the Jet Propulsion Lab was, you know, out of Caltech, who had nothing to do with German scientists. So I think we certainly bought 5 years worth of time, but overwhelmingly, all the true historians of science and technology, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a physicist or a mathematician, but I certainly have been immersed in this literature for years now. They all agree that what Wernher von Braun and that team did could have been done by American scientists, and was essentially with the Jet Propulsion Lab. It was in these what's mattered the most were these crucial years between 1945 and 1950. And after that, you just were allowing Germans, as opposed to Americans, to run these very high-level projects. And they did a great job, but there's no reason to think Americans wouldn't have done the same thing.
The work is called Our Germans, Project Paperclip and the National Security State. Tell me about that last portion, National Security State. What was the involvement with the Germans with that?
Well, first you have to ask, you know, what are the origins of the National Security State? Because the United States had nothing approximating an intelligence community or a big science or even armed services with research components
right
at the beginning of World War II. But by the end of World
War
II,
we sure had a lot then.
We had it was an amazing thing. So I have it was a great quote from Admiral Randall Jacobs, who was a leading figure in kind of building a scientific infrastructure for the war. And in 1945, he says, you know, imagine a war that began with Polish cavalry charging German tanks, that ended with the V2 over London and the atomic bomb. And he's right. That's the trajectory. You have essentially World War One era technology at the beginning of the war for all the powers, and then then guided missiles and an atomic bomb 6 years later. And so this the United States had created the term national security to describe the post-war world.
All right, hold on, Brian. We're going to hit the break, but we'll come back and talk more, and we'll open up the phone lines next on Coast to Coast AM.